While he grows up, I grow old, and by the time he's my age, hell, I'll be in my 60s. Jesus, I never planned to be old, you know.
Clark chuckled.
Yeah, neither did I. Relax, kid. Now I'm a... He almost said fucking, but Sandy didn't like that particular epithet. Goddamned grandfather. I never planned on that either.
It's not so bad, John, Sandy observed, cracking open the eggs. We can spoil him and hand him back. And we will.
It hadn't happened that way with their kids, at least not on John's side of the family. His mother was long dead from cancer, and his father from a heart attack on the job, while rescuing some children from a dwelling fire in Indianapolis, back in the late 1960s. John wondered if they knew that their son had grown up, and then grown old, and was now a grandfather. There was no telling, was there? Mortality and its attendant issues were normal at times like this, he supposed. The great continuity of life. What would John Connor Chavez become? Rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief? That was mainly Domingo and Patsy's job, and he had to trust them to do it properly. And they probably would. He knew his daughter, and knew Ding almost as well. From the first time he'd seen the kid, in the mountains of Colorado, he'd known that this boy had something special in him. And the younger man had grown, blossoming like a flower in a particularly tough garden. Domingo Chavez was a younger version of himself, a man of honor and courage, Clark told himself, and therefore he'd be a worthy father, as he'd proven to be a worthy husband. The great continuity of life, John told himself again, sipping his coffee and puffing on the cigar. And if it was yet one more milestone on the road to death, then so be it. He'd had an interesting life, and a life that had mattered to others, as had Domingo, and as they all hoped would, John Connor. And what the hell, Clark thought, his life wasn't over yet, was it? Getting a flight to New York had proven more difficult than expected. They were all fully booked, but finally Popoff had managed to get himself a coach seat in the back of an old United 727. He disliked the tight fit, but the flight was short. At LaGuardia, he headed for a cab. On the way out, checking his inside coat pocket, and finding the travel documents that had gotten him across the Atlantic. They had served him well, but they had to go. Emerging into the evening air, he surreptitiously dumped them into a trash container before walking to the cab stand. He was a weary man. His day had started just after midnight, American East Coast time, and he hadn't managed much sleep on the transatlantic flight, and his body was, how did the Americans put it, running on empty. Maybe that explained the break with Fieldcraft. 30 minutes later, Popoff was within blocks of his downtown apartment when the waste disposal crew circulated past the United Airlines terminal to change the trash bags. The routine was mechanical and fairly strenuous physical labor for the mostly Puerto Rican work crew. One at a time, they lifted the metal tops off the cans and reached in to remove the heavy-gauge plastic garbage bags, then turned to dump them into wheeled containers that would later be tipped into trucks for transport to a landfill on Staten Island. The routine was good upper-body exercise, and most of the men carried portable radios to help themselves deal with the boredom of the work. One can, 50 yards from the cab stand, didn't sit properly in its holder. When the cleanup man lifted the bag, it caught on a metallic edge and ripped, spilling its contents onto the concrete sidewalk. That generated a quiet curse from the worker, who now had to bend down and pick up a bunch of objects with his gloved hands. He was halfway through when he saw the crimson cardboard cover of what appeared to be a British passport. People didn't throw those things away, did they? He flipped it open and saw two credit cards inside, stamped with the same name on the passport. Saroff, he saw. An unusual name. He dropped the whole package into the thigh pocket of his coveralls. He'd bring it by the lost and found. It wasn't the first time he'd discovered valuable stuff in the trash. Once he'd even recovered a fully loaded 9mm pistol. By this time Popoff was in his apartment, too tired even to unpack his bags. Instead, he merely undressed and collapsed on the bed without even a vodka to help him off to sleep. By reflex, he turned on the TV and caught yet another story about the Hereford shootout. The TV was... Governor, shit, he thought. There was the TV truck whose reporter had come close and tried to interview him. They hadn't used it, but there he was, in profile, from 20 feet away, while the reporter gave a stand-up. All the more reason to clear out now, he thought, as he drifted off. He didn't even have the energy to switch the TV off, and he slept with it on, the recurring stories entering his mind and giving him confused and unpleasant dreams throughout the night. The passport, credit cards, and a few other items of apparent value arrived at the Waste Disposal Company's Staten Island office, actually a trailer that had been towed to the spot, after the close of regular business hours. The trash collector tossed it on the correct desk and punched his time card on the way out for his drive back to Queens and his usual late dinner. Tom Sullivan had worked late, and was now in the bar the FBI agents frequented, a block from the Jacob Javits Federal Building in Lower Manhattan. His partner, Frank Chatham, was there too, and the two agents sat in a booth, sipping at their Sam Adams beers. "Anything happening on your end?" Sullivan asked. He'd been in court all day, waiting to testify in a fraud case, but had never gotten to the witness stand because of procedural delays. "I talked with two girls today. They both say they know Kirk McLean, but neither one actually dated him," Chatham replied. "Looks like another dry hole. I mean, he was cooperative, wasn't he?" "Any other names associated with the missing girls?" Chatham shook his head. "Nope. They both said they saw him talking to the missing one, and he walked one out once, like he told us. But nothing special about it. Just the usual singles bar scene. Nothing that contradicts anything he said. Neither one likes McLean very much. They say he comes on to girls, asks some questions, and usually leaves them." "What kind of questions?" "Oh, the usual. Name, address, work, family stuff. Same stuff we ask, Tom." "The two girls you talked to today," Sullivan asked thoughtfully, "where are they from?" "One's a New Yorker, one's from across the river in Jersey."
"Bannister and Pretlow are from out of town," Sullivan pointed out.
"Yeah, I know. So?"
"So, if you're a serial killer, it's easier to take down victims with no close family members, isn't it?"
"Part of the selection process?"
"That's a stretch, Tom."
"Maybe, but what else we got?" The answer was not very much. The flyers handed out by the NYPD had turned up 15 people who'd said they recognized the faces, but they were unable to provide any useful information.
"I agree McLean was cooperative, but if he approaches girls, dumps those who grew up near here and have family here, then walks our victim home, hell, it's more than we have on anyone else."
"Go back to talk to him?"
Sullivan nodded.
"Yeah." It was just routine procedure. Kirk McLean hadn't struck either agent as a potential serial killer, but that was the best disguised form of criminal, both had learned in the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia. They also knew that the dullest of routine investigative work broke far more cases
than the miracles so beloved of mystery novels. Real police work was boring, mind-dulling repetition. And those who stuck with it won. Usually. It was strange that morning at Hereford. On the one hand, Team 2 was somewhat cowed by what had happened the day before. The loss of comrades did that to any unit. But on the other hand, their boss was now a father. And that was always the best thing to happen to a man. On the way to morning PT, a somewhat strung-out Team 2 leader, who'd had no sleep at all the night before, had his hand shaken by every member of the team, invariably with a brief word of congratulations and a knowing smile, since all of them were fathers already, even those younger than their boss. Morning PT was abbreviated in acknowledgment of his physical condition, and after the run, Eddie Price suggested to Chavez that he might as well drive home for a few hours of sleep, since he'd be of little use to anyone in his current condition. This Chavez did, crashing and burning past noon, and wakening with a screaming headache. As did Dmitri Popov. It hardly seemed fair, since he'd had little to drink the day before. He supposed it was his body's revenge on him for all the travel abuse on top of a long and exciting day west of London. He awoke to CNN on his bedroom TV and padded off to the bathroom for the usual morning routine, plus some aspirin, then to the kitchen to make coffee. In 2 hours he'd showered and dressed, unpacked his bags, and hung up the clothes he'd taken to Europe. The wrinkles would stretch out in a day or two, he thought. Then it was time for him to catch a cab for Midtown. On Staten Island, the lost and found person was a secretary who had this as one of her additional duties, and hated it. The items dropped on her desk were always smelly, sometimes enough to make her gag. Today was no exception, and she found herself wondering why people had to place such noxious items in the trash instead of... what? She never thought to wonder. Keep them in their pockets? The crimson passport was no exception. Joseph A. Seroff. The photo was of a man about 50, she thought, and about as remarkable to look at as a McDonald's hamburger. But it was a passport and 2 credit cards, and it belonged to somebody. She lifted the phone book from her desk and called the British consulate in Manhattan, told the operator what it was about, and got the passport control officer as a result. She didn't know that the passport control office had, for generations, been the semi-secret cover job for field officers of the Secret Intelligence Service. After a brief conversation, a company truck that was headed for Manhattan anyway dropped off the envelope at the consulate, where the door guard called to the proper office, and a secretary came down to collect it. This she dropped on the desk of her boss, Peter Williams. Williams really was a spook of sorts, a young man on his first field assignment outside his own country. It was typically a safe, comfortable job, in a major city of an allied country. And he did work a few agents, all of them diplomats working at the United Nations. From them he sought, and sometimes got, low-level diplomatic intelligence, which was forwarded to Whitehall to be examined and considered by equally low-level bureaucrats in the Foreign Office. This smelly passport was unusual. Though his job was supposed to handle things like this, in fact, he most often arranged substitute passports for people who'd somehow lost them in New York, which was not exactly a rare occurrence, though invariably an embarrassing one for the people who needed the replacements. The procedure was for Williams to fax the identification number on the document to London to identify the owner properly, and then call him or her at home, hoping to get a family member or employee who would know where the passport holder might be. But in this case, Williams got a telephone call from Whitehall barely 30 minutes after sending the information.
Peter?
Yes, Bert?
This passport, Joseph Seroff.
Rather strange thing just happened.
What's that?
The address we have for the chap is a mortuary, and the telephone number is to the same place. They've never heard of Joseph Saroff, alive or dead.
Oh? A false passport?
Williams lifted it from his desk blotter. If it were a fake, it was a damned good one.
So was something interesting happening for a change?
No, the computer has the passport number and name in it, but this Saroff chap doesn't live where he claims to live. I think it's a matter of false papers. The records show that he is a naturalized subject.
Want us to run that down as well?
Williams wondered about that. He'd seen false papers before, and been trained on how to obtain them for himself at the SIS Training Academy. Well, why not? Maybe he'd uncover a spy or something.
Yes, Bert, could you do that for me?
Call you tomorrow, the Foreign Office official promised. For his part, Peter Williams lit up his computer and sent an email to London. Just one more routine day for a young and very junior intelligence officer on his first posting abroad. New York was much like London, expensive, impersonal, and full of culture, but sadly lacking in the good manners of his hometown. Saroff, he thought. A Russian name, but you could find them everywhere. Quite a few in London. Even more in New York City, where so many of the cab drivers were right off the boat or plane from Mother Russia, and knew neither the English language nor where to find the landmarks of New York. Lost British passport, Russian name. 3,400 miles away, the name Saroff had been input onto the SIS computer system. The name had already been run for possible hits, and nothing of value had been found. But the executive program had many names and phrases, and it scanned for all of them. The name Saroff with a V was enough. It had also been entered spelled with two Fs and one F. And when the email from New York arrived, the computer seized upon and directed the message to a desk officer. Knowing that Joseph was the Russian version of Joseph, and since the passport description gave an age in the proper range, he flagged the message and forwarded it to the computer terminal of the person who had originated the inquiry on one Saroff, Joseph Andreevich. In due course, that message appeared as email on the desktop computer of Bill Tawney. Bloody useful things, computers, Tawney thought, as he printed up the message. New York. That was interesting. He called the number of the consulate and got Peter Williams.
"This passport from the Saroff chap, anything else you can tell me?" he asked, after establishing his credentials.
"Well, yes, there are two credit cards that were inside it, a MasterCard and a Visa, both platinum." Which, he didn't have to add, meant that they had relatively large credit limits.
"Very well. I want you to send me the photo and the credit card numbers over secure lines immediately."
Tawney gave him the correct numbers to call.
"Yes, sir. I'll do that at once,"
Williams replied earnestly, wondering what this was all about. And who the devil was William Tawney? Whoever it was, he was working late, since England was 5 hours ahead of New York, and Peter Williams was already wondering what he'd have for dinner.
"John?"
"Yeah, Bill," Clark replied tiredly, looking up from his desk and wondering if he'd get to see his grandson that day. "Our friend Saroff has turned up," the SIS man said next. That got a reaction. Clark's eyes narrowed at once.
"Oh, where?"
"New York. A British passport was found in a dustbin at LaGuardia Airport, along with two credit cards."
"Well," he amended his report, "the passport and credit cards were in the name of one Joseph A. Saroff."
"Run the cards to see if—" "I called the legal attaché in your embassy in London to have the accounts run, yes. Should have some information within the hour."
"Could be a break for us, John," Tawney added, with a hopeful voice.
"Who's handling it in the U.S.?"
"Gus Werner, Assistant Director, Terrorism Division. Ever met him?"
Clark shook his head.
"No, but I know the name."
I know Gus. Good chap.
The FBI has cordial relationships with all manner of businesses. Visa and MasterCard were no exceptions. An FBI agent called the headquarters of both companies from his desk in the Hoover Building and gave the card numbers to the chiefs of security of both companies. Both were former FBI agents themselves. The FBI sends many retired agents off to such positions, which creates a large and diverse old boy network. And both of them queried their computers and came up with account information, including name, address, credit history, and, most important of all, recent charges. The British Airways flight from London Heathrow to Chicago O'Hare leaped off the screen, actually the faxed page, at the agent's desk in Washington. "Yeah," Gus Werner said, when the young agent came into his office. "He caught a flight from London to Chicago late yesterday, and then a flight from Chicago to New York. About the last one, got a backroom ticket on standby. Must have dumped the ID right after he got in. Here." The agent handed over the charge records and the flight information. Werner scanned the pages. "No shit," the former chief of the hostage rescue team observed quietly. "This looks like a hit, Johnny." "Yes, sir," replied the young agent, fresh in from the Oklahoma City Field Division. "But it leaves one thing out. How he got to Europe this time. Everything else is documented, and there's a flight from Dublin to London. But nothing from here to Ireland," Special Agent James Washington told his boss. "Maybe he's got American Express." "Call and find out," Werner ordered the junior man. "Will do," Washington promised. "Who do I call on this?" Werner asked. "Right here, sir." Washington pointed to the number on the covering sheet. "Oh, good. I've met him. Thanks, Jimmy." Werner lifted his phone and dialed the international number. "Mr. Tawney, please," he told the operator. "It's Gus Werner calling from FBI headquarters in Washington."
"Hello, Gus. That was very fast of you," Tawney said, half in his overcoat and hoping to get home. "The wonders of the computer age, Bill. I have a possible hit on this Saroff guy. He flew from Heathrow to Chicago yesterday. The flight was about 3 hours after the fracas you had at Hereford. I have a rental car, a hotel bill, and a flight from Chicago to New York City after he got here." "Address?" "We're not that lucky. Post office box in Lower Manhattan," the assistant director told his counterpart. "Bill, how hot is this?"
"Gus, it's bloody hot. Sean Grady gave us the name, and one of the other prisoners confirmed it. The Saroff chap delivered a large sum of money and 10 pounds of cocaine shortly before the attack. We're working with the Swiss to track the money right now. And now it appears that this chap is based in America. Very interesting."
"No shit. We're going to have to track this mutt down if we can," Werner thought aloud. There was ample jurisdiction for the investigation he was about to open. American laws on terrorism reached across the world and had draconian penalties attached to them. And so did drug laws.
"You'll try?" Tawney asked.
"You bet your ass on that one, Bill," Werner replied positively. "I'm starting the case file myself. The hunt is on for Mr. Saroff."
"Excellent. Thank you, Gus."
Werner consulted his computer for a code word. This case would be important and classified. And the code word on the file would read... No, not that one. He told the machine to pick another. Yes. Prefect. A word he remembered from his Jesuit high school in St. Louis.
"Mr. Werner," his secretary called. "Mr. Henriksen is on line 3.
"Hey, Bill," Werner said, picking up the phone. "Cute little guy, isn't he?" Chavez asked.
John Connor Chavez was in his plastic crib tray, sleeping peacefully at the moment. The name card in the slot on the front established his identity, helped somewhat by an armed policeman in the nursery. There would be another on the maternity floor, and an SAS team of three soldiers on the hospital grounds. They were harder to identify, as they didn't have military haircuts. It was, again, the horse-gone, lock-the-door mentality. But Chavez didn't mind that people were around to protect his wife and child.
"Most of 'em are," John Clark agreed, remembering what Patsy and Maggie had been like at that age. Only yesterday, it so often seemed. Like most men, John always thought of his children as infants, never able to forget the first time he'd held them in their hospital-receiving blankets. And so now, again, he basked in the warm glow, knowing exactly how Ding felt, proud and a little intimidated by the responsibility that attended fatherhood. Well, that was how it was supposed to be. "Takes after his mother," John thought next, which meant after his side of the family, which he thought was good. But John wondered, with an ironic smile, if the little guy was dreaming in Spanish. And if he learned Spanish growing up, well, what was the harm in being bilingual? Then his beeper went off. John grumbled as he lifted it from his belt. Bill Tawney's number. He pulled his shoe phone from his pants pocket and dialed the number. It took 5 seconds for the encryption systems to synchronize.
"Yeah, Bill?"
"Good news. John, your FBI are tracking down this Seroff chap. I spoke with Gus Werner half an hour ago. They've established that he took a flight from Heathrow to Chicago yesterday, then on to New York. That's the address for his credit cards. The FBI are moving very quickly on this one." The next step was checking for a driver's license, and that came up dry, which meant they were also denied a photograph of the subject. The FBI agents checking it out in Albany were disappointed, but not especially surprised. The next step, for the next day, was to interview the postal employees at the station with the P.O. box.
"So, Dimitri, you got back here in a hurry," Breitling observed.
"It seemed a good idea," Popoff replied. "The mission was a mistake. The Rainbow Soldiers are too good for such an attack on them. Sean's people did well. Their planning struck me as excellent. But the enemy was far too proficient. The skill of these people is remarkable, as we saw before."
"Well, the attack must have shaken them up," his employer observed.
"Perhaps," Popoff allowed.
Just then, Henriksen walked in.
"Bad news," he announced.
"What's that?"
"Dimitri, you goofed up some, son."
"Oh? How did I do that?" the Russian asked, no small amount of irony in his voice.
"Not sure, but they know there was a Russian involved in queuing the attack on Rainbow. And the FBI is working the case now. They may know you're here."
"That is not possible," Popoff objected.
"Well, yes, they have Grady, and perhaps he talked. Yes, he did know that I flew in from America, or he could have figured that out, and he knows the cover name I used. But that identity is gone, destroyed." "Maybe so, but I was just on the phone with Gus Werner. I asked him about the Hereford incident, if there was anything I needed to know. He told me they've started a case looking for a Russian name, that they had reason to believe a Russian, possibly based in America, had been in contact with the PIRA. That means they know the name, Dimitri. And that means they'll be tracking down names on airline passenger lists." "Don't underestimate the FBI, pal," Henriksen warned.
"I do not," Popoff replied, now slightly worried, but only slightly. It would not be all that easy to check every transatlantic flight, even in the age of computers. He also decided that his next set of false ID papers would be in the name of Jones, Smith, Brown, or Johnson,
not that of a disgraced KGB chairman from the 1950s. The Saroff ID name had been a joke on his part. Not a good one, he decided now. Joseph Andrew Brown, that would be the next one, Dmitri Arkadyevich Popov thought, sitting there in the top-floor office.
"Is this a danger to us?" Breitling asked.
"If they find our friend here," Henriksen replied. Breitling nodded and thought quickly.
"Dmitri, have you ever been to Kansas?"
"Hello, Mr. McLean," Tom Sullivan said.
"Oh, hi. Want to talk to me some more?"
"Yes, if you don't mind," Frank Chatham told him.
"Okay, come on in," McLean said, opening the door all the way, walking back to his living room, and telling himself to be cool. He sat down and muted his TV.
"So, what do you want to know?"
"Anyone else you remember who might have been close to Mary Bannister?" The two agents saw McLean frown, then shake his head.
"Nobody I can put a name on. I mean, you know, it's a singles bar, and people bump into each other and talk, and make friends and stuff, you know."
He thought for a second more.
"Maybe one guy, but I don't know his name. Tall guy. About my age, sandy hair, big guy. Like he works out and stuff. But I don't know his name, sorry. Mary danced with him and had drinks with him, I think, but aside from that... Hey, it's too dark and crowded in there."
"And you walked her home just that one time?"
"Afraid so. We talked and joked some, but we never really hit it off, just casual. I never, made a move on her, if you know what I mean. Never got that far, like. Yeah, sure, I walked her home, but didn't even go in the building. Didn't kiss her goodnight, even. Just shook hands."
He saw Chatham taking notes.
Was this what he'd told them before?
He thought so, but it was hard to remember with two federal cops in his living room. The hell of it was, he didn't remember much about her. He'd selected her, loaded her into the truck, but that was all. He had no idea where she was now, though he imagined she was probably dead. McLean knew what that part of the project was all about, and that made him a kidnapper and accessory to murder. Two things he didn't exactly plan to give to these two FBI guys. New York had a death penalty statute now, and for all he knew, so did the federal government. Unconsciously, he licked his lips and rubbed his hands on his slacks as he leaned back on the couch. Then he stood and faced toward the kitchen.
"Can I get you guys anything?"
"No thanks, but you go right ahead," Sullivan said.
He'd just seen something he hadn't noticed in their first interview. Tension. Was it the occasional flips people got talking to FBI agents? Or was this guy trying to conceal something?
They watched McLean build a drink and come back.
"How would you describe Mary Bannister?" Sullivan asked.
"Pretty, but no knockout. Nice. Personable. I mean, pleasant. Sense of humor, sense of fun about her. Out-of-town girl in the big city for the first time. I mean, she's just a girl, you know."
"But nobody really close to her, you said."
"Not that I know of. But I didn't know her that well."
"What do other people say?"
"Well, people from the bar said you were pretty friendly with her."
"Well, maybe, yeah, but not that friendly. I mean, it never went anywhere. I never even kissed her."
He was repeating himself now as he sipped at his bourbon and water.
"Wish I did, but I didn't," he added.
"Who at the bar are you close to?" Chatham asked.
"Hey, that's kind of private, isn't it?" Kirk objected.
"Well, you know how it goes. We're trying to get a feel for the place, how it works, that sort of thing."
"Well, I don't kiss and tell, okay? Not my thing."
"'I can't blame you for that,' Sullivan observed with a smile, "'but it is kinda unusual for the singles bar crowd.' "'Oh, sure, there's guys there who put notches on their guns, but that's not my style.'
"'So Mary Bannister disappeared, and you didn't notice?'
"'Maybe, but I didn't think much about it. "'It's a transient community, you know. "'People come in and out, and some you never see again. "'They just disappear like—'
"'Ever call her?'
McLean frowned. "'No, I don't remember that she gave me her number.' I suppose she was in the book, but no, I never called her.
Just walked her home only that one time.
Right, just that one time, McLean confirmed, taking another pull on his drink and wishing these two inquisitors out of his home. Did they, could they know something? Why had they come back? Well, there was nothing in his apartment to confirm that he knew any female from the Turtle Inn. Well, just some phone numbers. But not so much as a loose sock from the women he'd occasionally brought here.
I mean, you guys looked around the first time you were here, McLean volunteered.
No big deal. We always ask to do that. It's just routine, Sullivan told their suspect.
Well, we have another appointment in a few minutes up the street. Thanks for letting us talk to you.
You still have my card?
Yeah, in the kitchen, stuck on the refrigerator.
Okay. Look, this case is kind of hard for us. Please think it over, and if you come up with anything, anything at all, please call me, okay?
Sure will.
McLean stood and walked them to the door, then came back to his drink and took another swallow.
He's nervous, Chatham said, out on the street.
Sure as hell. We have enough to do a background check on him?
No problem, Chatham replied.
Tomorrow morning, the senior agent said.
It was his second trip to Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, across the river from Manhattan. But this time it was a different aircraft, with Horizon Corp painted on the rudder fin. Dimitri played along, figuring that he could escape from any place in the United States, and knowing that Henriksen would warn Breitling not to try anything drastic. There was an element of anxiety to the trip, but no greater than his curiosity, and so Popoff settled into his seat on the left side and waited for the aircraft to start its engines and taxi out. There was even a flight attendant, a pretty one, to give him a shot of Finlandia vodka, which he sipped as the Gulfstream V started rolling. Kansas, he thought. A state of wheat fields and tornadoes, less than 3 hours away.
Mr. Henriksen?
Yeah, who's this?
Kirk McLean.
Anything wrong? Henriksen asked, alerted by the tone of his voice.
Chapter 31 Movement. The darkness hid the landscape. Popoff stepped off the aircraft and found a large military-type automobile waiting for him. Then he noticed the lines painted on the pavement and wondered if he'd landed on an airport runway or a country road of some sort. But no, in the distance was a huge building, partially lit. More curious than ever, Dimitri got into the vehicle and headed off toward it. His eyes gradually got accustomed to the darkness. The surrounding land seemed very flat, with only gentle rolls visible. Behind him, he saw a fuel truck had pulled up to the business jet, perhaps to send it back to New Jersey. Well, they were expensive, and doubtless Breitling and his people wanted it back where he could use it. Popoff didn't know that Horizon Corporation owned many of them. Their number just increased by 3 from the factory outside Savannah, Georgia. He was still jet-lagged, he found on entering the building. A uniformed security guard walked him to the elevator and then to his fourth-floor room, which was not unlike a medium-decent hotel room, complete with cooking facilities and a refrigerator. There was a TV and VCR, and all the tapes in the adjacent storage cupboard were
nature tapes he saw. Lions, bears, moose, spawning salmon. Not a single feature film. The magazines on the bedside table were similarly nature-oriented. How odd. But there was also a complete bar, including Absolut Vodka, which was almost as good as the Russian kind he preferred. He poured himself a drink and switched on the TV to CNN. Henriksen was being overly cautious, Dmitri thought. What could the FBI possibly have on him? A name? From that, they could perhaps develop... what? Credit cards, if they were very lucky. And from that, his travel records. But none of them would have evidentiary value in any court of law. No, unless Sean Grady positively identified him as a conduit of information and funds, he was totally safe. And Popoff thought he could depend on Grady not to cooperate with the British. He hated them too much to be cooperative. It was just a matter of crawling back into his hole and pulling it in after himself. An Americanism he admired. The money he'd stashed in the secondary Swiss account might be discoverable, but there were ways to handle that. Attorneys were so useful as an institution, he'd learned. Working through them was better than all the KGB field craft combined. No, if there was any danger to him, it was to be found in his employer, who might not know the rules of the game. But, even if he didn't, Henriksen would help. And so Dmitri relaxed and sipped his drink. He'd explore this place tomorrow, and, from the way he was treated, he'd know... no, there was an even easier way. He lifted his phone, hit 9 to get an outside line, then dialed his apartment in New York. The call went through. The phone rang 4 times before his answering machine clicked in. So, he had phone access to the outside. That meant he was safe. But he was no closer to understanding what was going on than he'd been during that first meeting in France, chatting with the American businessman and regaling him with tales of a former KGB field intelligence officer. Now here he was, in Kansas, USA, drinking vodka and watching television, with over $6 million American dollars in 2 numbered accounts in Switzerland. He'd reached one goal. Next, he had to meet another. What the hell was this adventure all about? Would he find out here? He hoped so. The airplanes were crammed with people, all of them inbound to Kingsford Smith International Airport outside Sydney. Many of them landed on the runway, which stuck out like a finger into Botany Bay, so famous as the landing point for criminals and other English rejects sent halfway round the world on wooden sailing ships to start a new country, which, to the disbelief of those who'd dispatched them, they'd done remarkably well. Many of the passengers on the inbound flights were young, fit athletes, the pride and pick of the countries that had sent them dressed in uniform clothing that proclaimed their nations of origin. Most were tourists, people with ticket and accommodation packages expensively bought from travel agents or given as gifts from political figures in their home countries. Many carried miniature flags. A few business passengers had listened to all manner of enthusiastic predictions for national glory at the Olympic Games, which would start in the next few days. On arriving, the athletes were treated like visiting royalty and conveyed to buses that would take them up Highway 64 to the city, and thence to the Olympic Village, which had been expensively built by the Australian government to house them. They could see the magnificent stadium nearby, and the athletes looked and wondered if they'd find personal glory there.
"So, Colonel, what do you think?"
"It's one hell of a stadium, and that's a fact," Colonel Wilson Gearing, U.S. Army Chemical Corps, retired, replied.
"But it sure gets hot here in the summer, pal."
"It's that El Niño business again. The ocean currents off South America have changed again, and that's associated with unusually hot temperatures here. It'll be in the mid-30s,
90s to you, I suppose, for the whole Olympiad. Well, I hope this fogging system works, 'cause if it doesn't, you'll have a lot of heat-stroke cases here, pal.
It works, the Aussie cop told him. It's fully tested.
Can I take a look at it now? Bill Henriksen wants me to see if it could be used as a chemical agent delivery system by the bad guys.
Certainly. This way.
They were there in 5 minutes. The water input piping was contained in its own locked room. The cop had the key for this and took the colonel inside.
Oh, you chlorinate the water here? Gehring asked in semi-surprise.
The water came in from the Sydney City water system, didn't it?
Yes, we don't want to spread any germs on our guests, do we?
Not exactly, Colonel Gehring agreed, looking at the plastic chlorine container that hung on the distribution piping beyond the actual pumps. Water was filtered through that before it went into the fogging nozzles that hung in all the concourses and ramps to the stadium bowl itself. The system would have to be flushed with unchlorinated water before delivery would work. But that was easily accomplished. And the false chlorine container in his hotel room was an exact twin of this one. The contents even looked like chlorine, almost, though the nanocapsules actually contained something called Shiva. Gehring thought about that behind blank brown eyes. He'd been a chemical weapons expert his whole professional life, having worked at the Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland and Dugway Proving Ground in Utah. But, well, this wasn't really chemical warfare. It was bio-war, a sister science of the one he'd studied for over 20 uniformed years.
"Is the door guarded?" he asked.
"No, but it is alarmed, and it takes some minutes to play with the system, as you can see. The alarm system reports to the command post, and we have an ample reaction force there."
"How ample?" the retired colonel asked next.
20 SAS members plus 20 police constables are there at all times, plus 10 more SAS circulating in pairs around the stadium. The people at the CP are armed with automatic weapons, the ones on patrol with pistols and radios. There is also a supplementary reaction force a kilometer distant with light-armored vehicles and heavy weapons, platoon strength. Beyond that, a battalion of infantry 20 kilometers away with helicopters and other support.
"Sounds good to me," Colonel Gehring said. "Can you give me the alarm code for this facility?" They didn't even hesitate. He was a former staff-grade Army officer, after all, and a senior member of the consulting team for security at the Olympic Games. 113-366, the senior cop told him. Gehring wrote it down, then punched the numbers into the keypad, which armed and then disarmed the system. He'd be able to switch out the chlorine canister very quickly. The system was designed for rapid servicing. This would work just fine, just like the model they'd set up in Kansas, on which he and his people had practiced for several days. They'd gotten the swap-out time down to 14 seconds. Anything under 20 meant that nobody would notice anything remiss in the fog-cooling system, because residual pressure would maintain the fogging stream. For the first time, Gehring saw the place where he'd be doing it, and that generated a slight chill in his blood. Planning was one thing. Seeing where it would happen for real was something else. This was the place. Here he would start a global plague that would take lives in numbers far too great to tally, and which in the end would leave alive only the elect. It would save the planet, at a ghastly price to be sure, but he'd been committed to this mission for years. He'd seen what man could do to harm things. He'd been a young lieutenant at Dugway Proving Grounds when they'd had the well-publicized accident with GB, a persistent nerve agent that had blown too far and slaughtered a few hundred sheep. And neurotoxins were not a pretty death, even for sheep. The news media hadn't even bothered to talk about the wild game that had died a similar ugly death, everything from insects to antelope. It had shaken him that his own organization, the United States Army,
could make so grave an error to cause such pain. The things he'd learned later had been worse. The binary agents he'd worked on for years, an effort to manufacture safe poisons for battlefield use. The crazy part was that it had all begun in Germany as insecticide research in the 1920s and 1930s. Most of the chemicals used to kill off insects were nerve agents, simple ones that attacked and destroyed the rudimentary nervous system in ants and beetles. But those German chemists had stumbled upon some of the deadliest chemical compounds ever formulated. So much of Goering's career had been spent with the intelligence community, evaluating information about possible chemical warfare plants in countries not trusted to have such things. But the problem with chemical weapons had always been their distribution. How to spread them evenly across a battlefield, thus exposing enemy soldiers efficiently. That the same chemicals would travel downrange and kill innocent civilians had been the dirty secret that the organizations and the governments that ruled them had always ignored. And they didn't even consider the wildlife that would also be exterminated in vast quantities. And worse still, the genetic damage those agents caused, because marginal doses of nerve gas, below the exposure needed to kill, invaded the very DNA of the victim, ensuring mutations that would last for generations. Goering had spent his life knowing these things, and he supposed that it had desensitized him to the taking of life in large quantities. This wasn't quite the same thing. He would not be spreading organophosphate chemical poisons, but rather tiny virus particles. And the people walking through the cooling fog in the concourses and ramps to the stadium bowl would breathe them in. And their body chemistry would break down the nanocapsules, allowing the Shiva strands to go to work. Slowly, of course. And they'd go home to spread the Shiva farther. And in 4 to 6 weeks after the ending of the Sydney Olympics, the plague would erupt worldwide, and a global panic would ensue. Then Horizon Corporation would announce that it had an experimental A vaccine that had worked in animals and primates, and was safe for human usage, ready for mass production. And so it would be mass-produced and distributed worldwide. And 4 to 6 weeks after injection, those people too would develop the Shiva symptoms. And with luck, the world would be depopulated down to a fractional percentage of the current population. Disorders would break out, killing many of the people blessed by nature with highly effective immune systems. And in 6 months or so, there would be just a few left, well-organized and well-equipped, safe in Kansas and Brazil. And in 6 months more, they would be the inheritors of a world returning to its natural state. This wouldn't be like Dugway, a purposeless accident. This would be a considered act by a man who'd contemplated mass murder for all of his professional life, but who'd only helped kill innocent animals. He turned to look at his hosts. "What's the extended weather forecast?"
"Hot and dry, old boy. I hope the athletes are fit. They'll need to be."
"Well, then, this fogging system will be a lifesaver," Goering observed. "Just so the wrong people don't fool with it. With your permission, I'll have my people keep an eye on this thing."
"Fine," the senior cop agreed.
The American was really fixated on this fogging system. But he'd been a gas soldier, and maybe that explained it. Popoff hadn't closed the shades the previous evening, and so the dawn awoke him rather abruptly. He opened his eyes, then squinted them in pain as the sun rose over the Kansas plains. The medicine cabinet in the bathroom, he found, had Tylenol and aspirin, and there were coffee grounds for the machine in the kitchen area, but nothing of value in the refrigerator. So he showered and had his coffee, then went out of the room looking for food. He found a cafeteria, a huge one, almost entirely empty of patrons, though there were a few people near the food tables, and there he went,
got breakfast, and sat alone, as he looked at the others in the cavernous room. Mainly people in their 30s and 40s, he thought, professional-looking, some wearing white laboratory coats.
"Mr. Popoff," a voice said. Dmitri turned.
"Yes?"
"I'm David Dawson, chief of security here. I have a badge for you to wear." He handed over a white plastic shield that pinned to his shirt. "And I'm supposed to show you around today. Welcome to Kansas."
"Thank you." Popoff pinned the badge on. It even had his picture on it, the Russian saw.
"You want to wear that at all times so that people know you belong here," Dawson explained helpfully.
"Yes, I understand."
So this place was pass-controlled, and it had a director of site security. How interesting. "How was your flight in last night?"
"Pleasant and uneventful," Popoff replied, sipping his second coffee of the morning. "So what is this place?"
"Well, Horizon set it up as a research facility. You know what the company does, right?"
"Yes," Popoff nodded. "Medicines and biological research, a world leader."
"Well, this is another research and development facility for their work. It was just finished recently. We're bringing people in now. It will soon be the company's main facility."
"Why here in the middle of nothing?" Popoff asked, looking around at the mainly empty cafeteria.
"Well, for starters, it's centrally located. You can be anywhere in the country in less than 3 hours, and nobody's around to bother us. It's a secure facility, too. Horizon does lots of work that requires protection, you see."
"Industrial espionage?"
Dawson nodded.
"That's right. We worry about that." "Will I be able to look around, see the grounds and such?"
"I'll drive you around myself. Mr. Henriksen told me to extend you the hospitality of the facility. Go ahead and finish your breakfast. I have a few things I have to do. I'll be back in about 15 minutes.
"Good, thank you," Popoff said, watching him walk out of the room. This would be useful. There was a strange institutional quality to this place, almost like a secure government facility. Like a Russian facility, Popoff thought. It seemed to have no soul at all, no character, no human dimension that he could identify. Even KGB would have hung a photo of Lenin on the huge, bare white walls to give the place some human scale. There was a wall of tinted windows which allowed him to see out to what happened to be wheat fields and a road, but nothing else. It was almost like being on a ship at sea, he thought, unlike anything he'd ever experienced. The former KGB officer worked through his breakfast, all of his instincts on alert, hoping to learn more, and as quickly as he could.
"Domingo, I need you to take this one," John said.
"It's a long way to go, John, and I just became a daddy," Chavez objected.
"Sorry, pal, but Covington is down. So's Chin. I'm going to send you and 4 men. It's an easy job, Ding. The Aussies know their stuff, but they asked us to come down and give it a look. And the reason for that is the expert way you handled your field assignments, okay?"
"When do I leave?"
"Tonight. 7:47 out of Heathrow." Clark held up the ticket envelope.
"Great," Chavez grumbled.
"Hey, at least you were there for the delivery, Pop."
"I suppose. What if something crops up while we're away?" Chavez tried as a weak final argument.
"We can scratch a team together, but you really think somebody's going to yank our chain any time soon? After we bagged those IRA pukes?"
"I don't," Clark concluded.
"What about the Russian guy, Serov?"
"The FBI's on it, trying to run him down in New York. They've assigned a bunch of agents to it."
One of them was Tom Sullivan. He was currently in the post office. Box 1453 at this station belonged to the mysterious Mr. Serov. It had some junk mail in it, and a visa bill, but no one had opened the box in at least 9 days, judging by the dates on the envelopes, and none of the clerks professed to know what the owner of Box 1453 looked like, though one thought he'd